Radio Doomsday Live. I'm your host, Mike Luckman. Tonight, we focus on Atlantis, the lost continent immortalized by Plato. And my special guest tonight is Frank Joseph, who's probably the world's foremost authority on Atlantis, having written about 14 or 15 books now that have been translated in 15 different languages. So we've got the right person, and we're going to be talking about Atlantis and the tie-in with the Mayans and what's coming up with their calendar and all that in just a moment. But first, I wanted to comment on some of the things that are happening in the news, and it's hard to say just where to begin. Probably the most stunning information of all comes out of Greenland. The ice shelf in Greenland, there's an ice shelf in Antarctica, which everyone knows, and also there's an ice shelf in Greenland. Well, in Greenland, NASA scientists were absolutely amazed and stunned and shocked to find out that 90% of the ice shelf has melted in this last week in a period of only 4 days. Now, I should back up and say that normally during the summer months, over a period of a couple of months, about 50% of the ice shelf melts and then freezes back over. 97% is unheard of, and also obviously has a great amount of importance when it comes to the rise of the ocean levels and flooding, potential flooding of coastal cities like New York City, where I'm based right here. Now, in addition to that ice shelf, you may have read about the blackout that hit India. We talked about the possibility of a power blackout if the power grid goes as a result of the solar flares that have been coming more and more in our direction, including some X-class solar flares, which can be extremely dangerous and cause massive blackouts and literally plunges into the dark ages. Well, for people who don't believe that this could happen, the blackout that struck India affected 650 million people. That's twice the number of people living in the United States. Now, the problem there didn't come from the sun, as far as we know. It came from an ancient infrastructure that's crumbling and that they're in great need of repair. So they have their hands full in India. Also, across the country in the United States, 40,000 heat records have been broken this year alone, and it's caused a devastating effect on the corn crops. About half of the corn crops are presently failing, and this, of course, will have a great effect on prices in the supermarket. There also isn't enough land for cattle to graze on that has grass growing on it. So all of these things tie in together, and, you know, as I've said time and time again, this is a this isn't a situation of business as usual. I wanted to recommend that people who are coming to this show for the first time, perhaps, should also check out the official December 21st, 2012 website, because there is the best information available on the planet about everything that's going on related to 2012. The exact website address is www.December212012.com. I'll repeat that. It's December212012.com. Okay, let me give out my number for anyone who wants to call up. We're at 1-888-429-5741. That's a toll-free number in the United States and Canada, 1-888-429-5741. Now, let's get to Frank Joseph and the story of Atlantis. Frank, incidentally, is a scuba diver, And the first question I have to ask you, Frank, is have you gone scuba diving? I've known you've made like hundreds and hundreds of dives. Have you gone in search of Atlantis? And if so, what have you found?
Well, I'm going to need more of a gear than a scuba outfit to go find poor old Atlantis. That's pretty deeper than I can get down with my regulator and my single tank. But I'm getting ready, I guess. I found a lot of great things. I have not been scuba diving for Atlantis. That's a legitimate question. I don't mean to laugh at you. But no, I haven't been scuba diving for Atlantis, but I have been involved in some archaeological dives in the mainland United States, and I've seen a lot of great things. For that, I only need to go down about 100 feet at most.
Okay. All right. Frank, what would you say of all of the evidence that you've come across for the existence of Atlantis? What would you say is some of the more compelling evidence?
Well, I would say that the single most persuasive that I have found, and it's a huge body of proof. Most of it's circumstantial, but legitimate circumstantial evidence. But there's some physical evidence that's really compelling. Plato, in his discussion, his very clear description of Atlantis that he talked about 2,400 years ago in two dialogues called the Critias and the Timaeus. And in the Critias, he says that the city of Atlantis was on a large island, and that this island was called Atlas. The name Atlantis is Greek, Atlantikos, which means the daughter of Atlas. In other words, the city is the product of the island or the mountain of Atlas, Mount Atlas. And he describes this large island as being in the near Atlantic. From a close reading of his work, it's clear that he refers to an island not too far outside of the Straits of Gibraltar, directly outside the Straits of Gibraltar. He called the Pillars of Hercules. That's what the Greeks called it in his day. And if you go out today, as oceanographers have for the past 60 years now, to a little over 200 miles due west of the Straits of Gibraltar, you will find at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean the remains of a large island. And this large island matches Plato's description in this important regard. He said that the island of Atlantis, or Atlas as its real name was almost entirely ringed by high mountains. And at the center, not the direct center, but pretty much on the south center end of the island, was a large, fairly large mountain, not like Mount Atlas or anything, but a large mountain, and it was volcanic, or at least it's given to understood that it's volcanic. He doesn't say it's volcanic. It's a large mountain. And if you go to the an area of the ocean that I've talked about, a little over 200 miles west of the Straits of Gibraltar, oceanographers have defined a sunken island, which they refer to as in an area known as the Hirondelle Deep. And in the Hirondelle Deep, not particularly far down, really only like about maybe at most 1,000 feet down, which is not deep for the Mid-Atlantic, you will find what is known as the Horseshoe Seamount. This Horseshoe Seamount is a large sunken island almost entirely surrounded by high mountains. And in the middle, towards the south, is a volcanic mountain which oceanographers refer to as Mount Ampere. Now, it's amazing, isn't it? It's rather startling. This is the only spot, not only in the Atlantic, but in all of the oceans of the world, that matches pretty generally Plato's description. And I think that's where we need to focus our investigation from now on. Now, there have been investigations of that area, but we must understand that the city of Atlantis, if it is down there, and I believe that there's a good chance that it is not just sitting like the Taj Mahal waiting for somebody like a scuba diver or a submarine to look out the window and see the ruins of Atlantis, because there's a phenomenon known in the ocean as deposition. Deposition is where organic material at the top on the surface of the sea constantly rains down decaying material. And this deposition loads up the bottom of the ocean with layer upon layer upon layer of silt and debris, organic debris. And it is under this collection, a series of layers that have been going on for thousands of years, obviously, that have covered the ruins of Atlantis. So we need the technology, perhaps it exists now. If it does, I don't have enough money for it at the present time, to examine the Horseshoe Seamount generally and Mount Ampere specifically, the south end of Mount Ampere, with the type of new technology that can look beneath the layers of silt. Much of it have turned to mud, compacted into mud. And that's what we need to probe beneath the bottom of the ocean to find what I believe will someday be found. I'm very confident. I've been examining this story of Atlantis since 1980. That's when I first got the Atlantis bug. Mm-hmm. And I've traveled around the world several times. This has been the main focus of my life since then. And outside of my marriage, just in case my wife is in earshot of this. But I believe that the day is coming when the technology will be at hand and a serious expedition will be undertaken, and I believe that Atlantis will be found. I believe that this civilization will be found. It's important because this was the mainspring of all modern civilizations. This was the first. There were civilizations before Atlantis, I believe, but this is the first modern one.
Right. Frank, why is it, would you say, that intrigues so much about Atlantis?
Well, I can only conjecture on that, but my personal feelings are how you started the show. You enumerated a number of very disturbing pieces of information about the deterioration of our biosphere, yeah, which literally threatens our whole civilization, threatens mankind. Well, this is nothing new. Civilizations have been exterminated, liquidated in the past. We're not the only ones faced with this, and we might very well be obliterated just exactly as Atlantis was. And I think that yes, there is a, I can just speculate, but I believe that there is a residual instinct or feeling that has kept this story alive for so many thousands of years because it is a rather frightening parallel. The people of Atlantis also, like ourselves, reached a very high level of material civilization, a great technology, tremendous political, military, and economic power, and they began, the story is universally, you see this interpretation around the world in the traditions of native peoples everywhere that hold this place in their collective memory, that these people eventually abused the natural environment to such an extent that nature reacted, snapped back at them,
wow,
and wiped out their civilization in its tracks.
So the parallels are really right there in front of us.
I think the parallels are very close, and Plato mentions this himself. He says that the Atlanteans began as a very noble people, a spiritually awake people, kind of like very similar to the early Americans that he's describing. He's describing this like the pioneer spirit and the idea of our founding fathers and liberty and all that authoritarian republic and all the great stuff. And then they became self-indulgent, the Atlanteans, Plato says, self-indulgent, and felt they could do anything and became obsessed with wealth, and so much so that they just continued to abuse the environment. And the gods didn't appreciate this and punished Atlantis for its imbalance. Now, what's remarkable about Plato's interpretation of the destruction of Atlantis, he has a moral interpretation mm-hmm. of it, you find this precisely, or at least in a very general way, the same interpretation amongst the native peoples of ancient of pre-Columbian Mexico, of Western mm-hmm. Europe, West Africa. They all talk about this primal civilization on a beautiful island that reached very high levels of culture, and then its people became corrupt, and they suffered a natural catastrophe, and the survivors came to different parts of the world and told this story.
Yes.
So I think it's that alone, that this consistency of myth that you find amongst peoples, obviously totally unrelated to one another, tends to confirm that something happened.
Yeah. My friend, Hanbats Men, who's the Mayan, one of the Mayan solar priests who I met last year in New York City at an event here, told me that the Mayans consider themselves related directly, that is, the descendants of the Atlanteans. What can you tell my listeners about that?
Well, what Hunbat's men told you is absolutely consistent with what the Maya have been saying for hundreds and thousands of years. They told the same story to the Spaniards, and they told it to themselves long before. They did not use the same word Atlantis. That is that's a European term. That's a Greek term. They used the name for Atlantis. They called it Patutlan. That was one of its names, Patutlan.
Okay.
And their story, which anybody listening to this can find this out for themselves. They don't have to take my version on account. There's a book that you can get at Amazon.com, as a matter of fact. It's called the Popol Vuh, P-O-L-V-U-H, the Popol Vuh, which in Mayan means the Book of Counsel. And in the Book of Counsel are preserved many of the Maya cosmological myths, their founding myths. And in the Popol Vuh, you can read, this was put together actually about the time of the Spanish conquest, a little before. I'm sure there were alterations afterwards, because the Spanish priests, the Catholic priests, were very interested in the Maya religion, all the better to dismantle it. And in the Popol Vuh, you can read how Maya civilization started. They say that Kukulkan, the feathered serpent, and his family and followers, mostly sorcerers, originally lived on a large island in the Sunrise Sea, as they say. That's their name for the Atlantic Ocean, on an island they called Patutlan. And Patutlan was a place of great high learning and achievement. It suffered a natural catastrophe, was destroyed, sank into the sea. Kukulkan and his followers, his family, survived in a fleet of ships. They crossed the ocean. They arrived on the shores of Yucatan. And unlike future conquerors like ourselves, they didn't dominate the Maya. They didn't dominate the local people. They shared their technology with them. And the result, Maya civilization, was considered a hybrid between the local people's culture and this high technology that was ushered in by Kukulkan and his followers.
Now, on the technology issue, how would you compare, from what you know, from all of your years of research, how would you compare the level of technology reached by the Atlanteans, from what you know, to our technology today?
There have been many claims that the Atlanteans have achieved all kinds of high levels of technology, like the use of aircraft and so forth. And I don't discount any of that. I'm trying to be a real scientist. I keep my mind open. Everything should be on the table. I've not been able to find that the Atlanteans mastered flight or anything quite as extraordinary as that. However, there is no doubt that the Atlanteans were in possession of an extremely high metallurgy, that they were many years ahead of their time. They might have been actually the first metallurgists, at least on a large scale, and there's proof of that. The proof of that is here in the United States, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Most people have no idea that 5,000 years ago, before Egypt was even begun, or right, the first dynasty at the very earliest time, there was an incredibly huge mining enterprise that was underway in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan on the shores of Lake Superior and concentrated on a large island called Isle Royale that you can visit today. And the remains of this mining enterprise... Yes? What?
Yes, what was being mined exactly? Was
copper. Copper.
Copper.
Copper on an enormous industrial scale. Between 3,100 B.C. and 1,200 B.C., a conservative amount, ultra-conservative amount, of the world's highest-grade copper was removed from the Michigan Peninsula, and the conservative amount for that is half a billion pounds. And the remains of these mines are intact. There are over 5,000 of these mines. There are over 5,000 of them. They're pit mines. Some of them go down to 60 feet through solid bedrock. Nobody knows who on earth possessed the kind of technology that could do such a thing. The Native Americans at that time, and mainstream archaeologists will tell you, they either didn't live in that area at that time, or there were very few of them. They possessed a very low material level of culture. The natives of that area, the descendants of them, are the Menominee Indians. And the Menominee Indians say that those mines were worked by a people they call the Marine Men, or the Sea People. They describe them as a white people who were in possession of great fleets of ships. And they say in their traditions that these Marine Men wounded Mother Earth by extracting her shiny bones. Well, of course, this is a poetic way of saying that they're mining copper. And this, the mystery of this. Pardon me.
What was the copper? What was the copper used for exactly? Do you think?
The copper. This is what I'm getting to here. Here's this enormous mining enterprise that took place in Michigan. At the same time, the Bronze Age erupted in Western Europe and the Near East. Now, in order to make bronze, you have to have three components. You have to have good copper. You have to have zinc and tin. Well, in the Near East and in Western Europe, you do have copper, but not that much, and it's not really that high quality. The copper deposits in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the highest copper, the highest grade copper deposits on Earth, they yield huge amounts. The bronze that was manufactured, as you and everybody knows, the bronze quality, the quality of workmanship in the Bronze Age was incredibly high. Many of the tools and the weapons of that time still survive because they're so excellent. If they were made of inferior grade copper, they would not hold up as the tools that created things like the Great Pyramid. They would not hold up as the great weapons that won the War of Troy. In order to do that, you had to have great copper. And you didn't have that great high copper in Western Europe. You got some a little bit from Cyprus. Matter of fact, the name Cyprus comes from the Assyrian word for copper, Kippur. The other thing that clinches it, while these people were Atlanteans, foreigners mining this American copper, was that also tin mines have been found, ancient tin mines, right along with the copper mines in Michigan. That means then that these people were mining zinc, and zinc is common everywhere, you don't need to bother about that, but the tin and the copper were mined together, mostly copper, however, in order to create bronze. So, and this is just exactly how Plato describes the Atlanteans. If you go back and you read his Critias, he describes them as basing their wealth on their metallurgy. They are great miners and metallurgists.
What about the role of crystals with the Atlanteans?
That's a fascinating aspect of the story of Atlantis. Now, Plato mentions nothing at all about crystals, but in the traditions of other peoples associated with Atlantis, crystals are often mentioned. For example, there are various tribes of Native American, Native Americans of the Sioux Nation, who talk about one of their founding fathers. Matter of fact, their founding father, who arrived after a great flood, leading his people to Turtle Island, which is their name for North America, and he held aloft a great crystal as a badge of his authority. Crystals have been associated with flood survivors in an Atlantean context, literally around the world. And I devoted one book, especially the book I worked hardest on and longest, relating directly to the use of crystals in the Atlantis story. And it's huge. It's big. And it would appear that, of course, crystals are very common. You can find them anywhere. But crystals are used in our technology today, aren't they? I mean, Silicon Valley, what are we talking about here, you know?
Sure.
And I think that the Atlanteans, this is where we can get into their technology. I believe, and I hope I've amassed enough evidence to show that the Atlanteans were in possession of an electronic technology. It was completely different technology than our own. Its purposes were completely different than ours. It was not utilitarian, but it was of a metaphysical nature. to help alter human states of consciousness. I believe that they used it for that. We do that too. We have a negative ion therapy, and I think that they were involved in something similar to that. And I believe that they did master a kind of electrical quartz technology. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, Frank, you've written a new book about Atlantis in 2012. What's the connection there?
The connection is, I would hope, somewhat obvious. 2012 is a very interesting year because the Mayan calendar is coming to a close, and it is on the winter solstice, which is the coming December 21st. And it's a rather ominous time because the Maya themselves, I investigated their own traditions in this book, the Maya themselves talked about a very difficult time for us living here at this time. They talk about the arrival on the morning of December 21st, 2012, the arrival of Balon Yokte and his nine servants. Balon Yokte in Maya mythology was the equivalent of our Satan, and his nine servants are demonic figures. This is a mythological way of saying that something bad is supposed to happen. He's supposed to come either out of the sun or somewhere out of the sky. That is not clear. The Maya said, however, that this is not inevitable, that human beings always have the power within their own hands to change fate. However, if they continue on a self-indulgent course, they can only expect the worst. That's really what the Maya are saying. And
what about extraterrestrials? Where do they fit into all this?
I've been very reluctant to bring in the extraterrestrial question. I'm trying to examine the story of Atlantis from a scientific point of view. This doesn't mean that I'm skeptical. I don't like skeptics. I think skeptics have closed minds. But being a true scientist is someone who is, as the name indicates, it wants the truth, just what really happened. And in order to do that, you have to consider everything, including the extraterrestrial question. You cannot say
well,
that any information...
Mayans...
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the Mayans strongly believe that that extraterrestrials are going to be coming back very soon.
Well... that's something that needs to be taken into consideration. My own experience in examining the question of 2012 and the story of Atlantis I've not really come across the extraterrestrial question, except, as you say, there are traditions amongst the Maya that do indicate something like that happened or will happen. But that's an interpretation. Another interpretation is that the Maya were involved in astral projection, which is even more difficult to understand and to accept for some critics than others. But I believe that the Maya were, I have no doubt that the Maya were involved in the expansion of human consciousness. I think there probably even mainstream scholars wouldn't disagree with me there. I think the Maya used various techniques including narcotics, in order to achieve this altered state of consciousness, to expand their thinking, their thought processes backward and forward in time. I know whether they deluded themselves or whether they actually achieved it, that's something, I guess, for our listeners to decide.
Right. What do you personally think might happen on December 21st, 2012? Do you have any idea?
We have to understand that this date was chosen symbolically, that the Maya were very poetic people. They spoke and thought in terms of analogies. 2012, that date is December 21st, and December 21st is the winter solstice in the northern hemisphere. That means, on the winter solstice, that it is the longest night of the year. This was always a very frightening time for pre-modern people. It looked like the sun was going away. Darkness is associated with danger and ignorance. And then after, of course, the winter solstice, the sun slowly begins to come back. I believe that this date was chosen allegorically. I don't believe that it was chosen specifically that something is going to happen on that date. However, I will say this, that I believe that this date was chosen specifically, the winter solstice, to indicate an event horizon, a line in time that if we cross and we haven't gotten our act together, at least partially, will be very rough for us. I think in the future that we will look back on December 21st, 2012 as part of a barrier that we crossed. I don't believe that on that, I'd be very surprised if anything specifically happened on that day. I don't know the future. I'm not an astrologer. But I do believe that that period of time was chosen specifically by the Maya to indicate we had better look out, that we have to understand that we have to live according to the basic principles of nature as we understand them, or else those principles of nature will snap back on us, they'll recoil on us, and they will wipe out our civilization just as Atlantis had her civilization wiped out. And Atlantis is not unique. Either are we unique. There have been many, many civilizations that have risen and fallen for various reasons, and some because they abuse the environment. Even mainstream conventional archaeologists know that the high civilization of Easter Island, for example, in the Pacific, that civilization committed suicide because they destroyed the ecological basis for their existence. That's just as a microcosm of other civilizations, including our own. If somebody had warned the Easter Islanders ahead of time, they could have saved themselves and they'd still be here today. But they didn't.
You know, the original story about the Mayan calendar, misperception about the Mayan calendar, of course, was that the world was going to come to an end on December 21st. A surprising number of people, according to a Reuters poll conducted recently, surprising number of people, about 10% of the world population, believe that the world will come to an end on December 21st. 2012. Now, I've been saying from the beginning of these broadcasts that I don't believe that for one second, and I think that people should be really careful to get into that, you know, frame of mind. On the other hand, however, the earth changes and the environmental disasters that are coming our way with increasing ferocity is something that they're extremely concerned about, and even though they feel that we'll reach a new spiritual level during this general time period, not on December 21st specifically, but in the general time period that we're living in right now, referred to the Bible as the end times, that it is fraught with all kinds of danger. And they actually believe that there could be a pole shift, which is something that Albert Einstein subscribed to as a possibility. And that millions of people, in fact, a lot more than millions of people, might not make it as a result of this kind of a cataclysmic event. And of course, they also believe in, the Mayans believe in the existence of Planet X. Planet X is one of the subjects that I'm very inclined toward, having been a friend of Zechariah Sitchin, the author, about all these books about Planet X and the Sumerian civilization and formation of that, including apparent contact with beings from Planet X known as the Anunnaki. What is your take on Planet X? Do you have any thoughts about it?
Well, first of all, I completely subscribe to everything you've said. I just underline everything you said. I'm in complete agreement with every word. I'm very grateful, always be grateful to the memory of Zachariah Sitchin, because he was kind enough to write a foreword for my book, The Destruction of Atlantis, 12 years ago. And I since cooperated. He was very instrumental, helping me get published at that time. And he's since that time, and before he passed away, he worked with me. We worked together on a book together, and I'm very happy to be sharing that book. When it's called Discovering the Mysteries of Ancient America, and so I'm very glad that we were able to do that before he passed away. As far as planet X is concerned, the universe is rather limitless, isn't it? I mean, anything, absolutely anything is possible. So for critics to just dismiss that out of hand, you know, it just shows their abysmal ignorance. But I agree with everything you have to say. I think that the whole concept of the Maya prophecy, as it were, is not the end of the world. The world will not end. The world will be around for a long time, another, 5 to 7 billion years. But we may not be. Our civilization may not. We're not talking about the end of the world. We're talking about the end of our civilization. That's really possible. We've done just about everything we can to undermine the foundations of our existence and certainly the existence of future generations. And but I don't believe, though, that that's going to happen. I just have this dumb faith, I guess, in mankind. I think we're going to get shaken up. I think we're going to go through some really wild times. Buckle up. The next few generations have got to buckle up. We're going to have a really rough ride. But I think it's going to be good at the end. You know, 75,000 years ago, something interesting happened. So the largest volcanic eruption known to science was called Mount Toba. It's in Indonesia. And when this eruption took place, it was bigger than anything known to science. At that time, there were between 2 and 2.5 million human beings on Earth. We know that through the DNA studies, about 2.5 million. After Mount Toba blew up and subsided, of those 2 to 2.5 million human beings, there were only at most 1,200 breeding pairs of human beings left. That's all. 1,200 pairs of human beings left from 2 to 2.5 million. But you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to us. You know why? Because it wiped out all of these lesser human experiments that were caught in an evolutionary deadlock, these other proto-human beings. And our descendants from that time were tough. It is our immunity system that we have today. It is our adaptability, our intelligence, our physical strength. Everything comes directly from those tough people that survived Mount Toba. So even though at that time it was the greatest holocaust that human beings had ever gone through up to that point, to be virtually snuffed out, to be put to the edge, the absolute brink of extinction. But we came back, and it was for our benefit. Well, we may be going through the same thing where most of us are going to get whacked. And I can't leave myself out of that either. I might get shuffled off also. There's nothing I can do about it. But our descendants from this, they're going to be, compared to what we are today, they're going to be superhuman. Just like our descendants after Mount Toba were relatively superhuman, what the civilization they created after Mount Toba, they were not capable of civilization before. But afterwards, they were. And in fact, the very beginnings, the earliest hint of civilization is right around that time when our descendants, our ancestors rather, walked away from Mount Toba. Most of them didn't, but the few that did, they could do the job. I think it's the same with us. I think there's a lot of people that are going to be gone, but the few that survive, it'll be good for the species, put it that way.
Yeah. I've been telling the listeners about the need to make preparations for the worst-case scenario, or even for some of the things that are happening right here today. Are you doing anything? You're in Mississippi, is it?
No, I'm in Minnesota. And
you're in Minnesota. What are you doing, if anything, to prepare for these earth changes and surviving this period of this very difficult period of time?
There is only one. I believe that the magnitude of the changes that are coming are going to be so huge that the only thing that you can do, there's nothing you can store, you can't have ammunition or food and all that. Not that I'm telling people not to do that. If they want to do that, that's fine. But that's all finite. I've given it some thought, and I figured that if worse comes to worse, the only thing that we can do is to form alliances as individuals. You go out and you go to those people that you can trust. you're going to need cooperation. Cooperation is the basis of civilization. That's why our civilization is deteriorating, because people have lost their sense of cohesion. They've lost their sense of national familyhood.
Right.
Look at the rudeness that Americans are with. Americans have never been so mad at each other as rude, and hate each other as much as they've hated each other today. How discourteous they are. I mean, that's just natural. Well, that's a sign that a civilization is unraveling. So if something bad happens and you'll have nothing left to really work with, you no services, I think that you can't call anybody up. Nobody's going to help you. You have to rely on your neighbors, your family, those people that you can trust. You have to be very careful. You can't trust everybody, but those people that you can put your faith in, I think from these little nuclear cells of trust, things will start over. We have to be reduced to the tribal level again. And
right.
I think that's what's going to happen. I've written the book that I've written most on this is called Atlantis in 2012. That's the most up-to-date thing. And that, I think, explains a lot of things.
Get that book, Frank?
Amazon.com, that's the place to go, or in the books, the dwindling number of bookstores, they can get copies there. But Amazon.com, they can get it there.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Radio Doomsday Live. I'm your host, Mike Luckman. The phone number, if you have any questions, is 1-888-429-5741. That's 1-888-429-5741. The show is broadcast every Thursday night at 12 midnight Eastern Time and 9 p.m. Pacific Time over BBS Radio on station number 2. And please tell your friends about it. We've gotten a tremendous amount of support from the news media. We were recently the subject of a story in the Huffington Post, in USA Today. We're all over the Internet. And also a story that was done by GlobalPost.com, which is a major news organization, got picked up even on the official NASDAQ website, the stock exchange website. So word is getting around, but we want to spread it as quickly as we can. Frank, please tell us about this very unusual event that is being planned on the water, this cruise. Sort of an end of the world as we know it cruise that's going to happen the week before the December 21st date down in Florida and going to Mexico. Who's going to be on that cruise and what is its purpose and what will you be doing there?
Well, I never thought of that way, but that's pretty good. Cruise to oblivion. Well, it might just be. What a way to end the whole thing, you know, on a beautiful ship. We're going to be on one of the biggest ships ever built. It's huge, called the Liberty of the Seas. It's gigantic. It's like a floating city. And it's going to be interesting because there are going to be a number of really terrific presenters there. I'm going to be in some pretty fast company. Stephen Mailer, an Egyptologist, very brilliant man.
Yes.
And we're going to be cruising from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, like you say, just the week before the big event. And we're going to the island of Cozumel, off coast of Yucatan. And what's fabulous about that is Cozumel was the sacred island to the Maya of the goddess Ixchel. What a beautiful name, Ixchel, I-X-C-H-E-L, it's usually spelled. And the goddess Ixchel is Atlantean as you can hope for. She's described as the white lady who came from Patutlan after her own island far across the sea burst into flames and sank into the sea, and she brought with her and her husband, Itzamna, all of this wonderful high technology. And she's symbolized by the crystal skull. Isn't that cool? So we're going to be going to Cozumel. We're going to visit her temple. She's a very great goddess, and we'll be paying her homage down there. And we're going to be talking about how her wonderful mythology is very much alive and relates to what's going on today.
Yeah, and
people are interested.
A gentleman who's a well-known artist from Mexico, who recently unearthed about nine crystal skulls, ancient crystal skulls, is going to be part of that cruise?
Yes, I believe that gentleman is going to be there also. You know, it's an interesting thing. A friend of mine who's not going to be on this, Dr. John DeSalvo, a PhD, spoken for the United Nations and all this great stuff, he came into possession of a really fascinating crystal skull that has been completely authenticated. A number of these crystal skulls coming out today, just because people claim that they're authentic or real in any way, doesn't mean that they are. There are a lot of fakes out there. You have to be careful. But this one that Dr. DeSalvo was able to get is from China. And he took it to Scott Walter, who is a world-class geologist, to his laboratory in St. Paul, not too far from where I am. And they authenticated this thing as, you know, about 4,000 years old.
4,000, wow.
Crystal skull. And the interesting thing about it is, it gets really weird. It's well done. It's rather crude, but it's well done. And the weathering on it shows that it's about 4,000 years old. They even were able to determine the culture, the specific Chinese culture that it was associated with. But the skull itself seems to be a model, and it's a model of.
Frank, what do you think the message of the crystal skulls might be? Because according to the Mayan mythology, 13 ancient crystal skulls are to be united. They'll all be in one place at one time. When humanity was at a crossroads, which it clearly is right now, what do you think the message might be from those crystal skulls if you feel like they're capable of transmitting any kind of a message?
Well, I wouldn't want to speak for them. But I would think it's exactly what we've been discussing this evening. I presume that the discovery of these wonderful objects at this time would seem to indicate what is implied in the winter solstice that's coming up, which is a turning point. You know, are human beings going to begin to get their act together, or are they just going to continue with their self-indulgence and see where that leads? I think that that's really what this means. The skull, what does the skull mean? It's a symbol of death on the one hand, and it's also the crystal skull is a medium of transformation. So you have both positive and negative aspects of it. You have destruction and death on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got transformation, something higher. And so I think that that indicates just what's going on here, that human beings have to understand, we have to understand that our civilization is very, very fragile at this moment. I mean, you talked about the earth changes going on here. I live in Minnesota. Minnesota is a cold state. I know, I've been here for a long time. I mean, it's freezing cold here, right? Last February, the last week in February, which is like the coldest time of the year here, we had one week of 80-degree temperatures. 80 degrees! That had never happened before. And people brushed it aside. Wasn't it wonderful, you know? I was alarmed. I mean, I think anybody that could think was alarmed. Something is radically wrong here.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Ken Morgan, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, from Oracle Stone Productions, is the guy who's been behind many of these crystal skulls, many of these major crystal skull events, and is the guy who's producing this this cruise that we were talking about earlier in the program. I want to remind you that you're listening to Radio Doomsday Live. We're on live every Thursday night at 12 midnight Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, over BBS Radio station number 2. They're great people we'll work with. I really want to compliment them. And we have a few minutes left. If anyone has any questions, please now would be the time to call in. It's 1-888-429-5741. And Frank, is there anything that we've left out? I mean, I know that you've written all of these books, and that it just goes on this subject, but what else do you think my listeners might be interested in?
Well, you did mention the cruise that we're going to have in mid-December. If any of our listeners are interested in that, they can look it up. They can see what it's all about. It's at www.crystalskulls, that's with an S plural, crystalskullsevent.com.
Right.
And that's photos of everything, and it has Stephen Mailer and all the rest of the wonderful presenters at that time. And if anyone's interested in my book, which is called Atlantis and 2012, what we're talking about here today, they can just go to Amazon.com and find it, or they can get it at Barnes & Noble. I believe it's still on the shelf.
I was privileged to meet four of the Mayan elders, including Hun Bach Men, the Mayan solar priest, about a year and a half ago here in New York City. And one of the things that he said would take place, and we did this at a news conference here in New York, was that there would be a UFO activity, and lo and behold, there was. There were a great number of sightings of UFOs in New York City, area, downtown New York, where I happen to live, in the Chelsea area. It was covered amazingly by the news media. They tried to write it off as balloons, and there may have been some balloons there, but the fact of the matter is that they had the airports on high security alert in the New York area, and something very peculiar, very interesting was going on. Now, I know that you have, the extraterrestrial subject is something that you have perhaps somewhat mixed feelings about, or at least you may not be as diehard a UFO buff as I am. I got to tell you that I have, Frank, I'm in possession of 400 videotaped depositions by former military people, most of whom are intelligence officers, most of whom worked in the Pentagon in the 1960s and 70s.
Wow.
And they clearly state over and over again that Roswell was a real event in 1947 in New Mexico, that there was a real crash with the recovery of beings, that there's a worldwide UFO cover-up, that they have personally observed UFOs, and that they think that they are highly advanced. Something very interesting happened at that event. It was called The Legend of the 13 Crystal Skulls, which Ken Morgan produced this event here at the FIT Auditorium in New York. And out of the 13 crystal skulls, four of them had physical changes associated with them in the weeks and months following. Four of the skulls went from a milky white to clear, but only on the left side of the skull, and nobody knows what that really adds up to, what that means. But something definitely did take place. It was an extraordinary event. My hats off to Ken Morgan on that, and I'll never forget that event. There was definitely an energy in the room, and there were about 500 people parading around the outer perimeter of the auditorium. Most of whom, by the way, had their own crystal skulls. Not only were there the Mayan elders and the 13 ancient crystal skulls, but there were also many, many people. I would say at least half of the 500 people, this is, I was very surprised, and they came from all over the world, had their own crystal skulls. It's almost bordering on a religion.
Well, I do believe in the extraterrestrial phenomena. I just try to separate it from Atlantis so far because I have not seen that connection very well. There are some indications. As a matter of fact, I've written a book on that. It's called 2012 Alien Revelation, and that's on Kindle, by the way. You can only get that on Kindle. I think it's for $9. So if people are interested in that. And the reason I wrote that was because a friend of mine, a friend of our family who was really, still really appreciated for his honesty and his straightforwardness, shared with us his abduction experiences that he had over the course of his whole life, from the time that he was a small infant or maybe even before, all the way up until his 30th year. And so I put that in the form of a novel because I was not allowed to use his name or talk about where he really lived and things like that.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, in 2012 Alien Revelation, I am able to put in this dramatized form all of the true stories that he told me. So I'm quite a believer in the abduction experience. I think that the Roswell incident cannot be denied. It is, I think, it absolutely happened. And it sounds like you have a real treasure trove of very valuable information that I would like to see get out more.
You know, many of the UFO abductees report, or quite a few of them anyway, report that they have been shown by their alien captors, if we could call them that, by the aliens in any event, or by the extraterrestrial beings that they're in contact with, that they've been shown what amounts to almost like a film clip or a video clip of the world, of planet Earth in the immediate future. And they're being shown scenes of devastation of this planet. If that doesn't tell
all you have to do, you don't have to go on board, you don't have to go aboard a spaceship, though, to see it. Just turn on the nightly news, and you can see great swaths of devastation going on now. Of course, it's all dismissed as, you know, El Nino or something. But nonetheless, we're witnessing that right today, as a matter of fact. You know, these unprecedented fires out west.
Every day. I want to thank you, Frank, for being my guest on Radio Doomsday Live. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on every Thursday night at 12 midnight Eastern Time and 9 p.m. Pacific Time. And I'd like to urge you to tune in next week to the program, when my guest will be Grant Cameron, who runs the Presidential UFO .com website. Grant is an amazing gentleman who has gone to the presidential libraries in his quest for documentation about knowledge by American presidents. He happens to be Canadian himself, but he spent a lot of time over here in the United States researching the involvement. And I've talked before about Bill and Hillary Clinton and Roswell. I will get back to that in future shows. Again, thanks very much, Frank, for being my guest on Radio Doomsday Live. Tune in next time, if there is a next time.